It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about a documentary film that turns a lens on a UFO festival in a small town here in Wisconsin. First, Governor Walker appointed a new secretary to the state's Department of Veterans Affairs today. Daniel Zimmerman will replace the former VA secretary who left office last month. The department has seen some shakeups in the last several months. The changes came after one of the state's largest veterans' homes became the subject of allegations of poor conditions and resident care. Glenn Moberg joins us now to tell us more. He's a reporter, host, and news bureau chief for WPR in Wausau. Glenn, welcome back.
Well, hi, Veronica. Good to be here.
Well, Glenn, what do we know about Daniel Zimmerman, the new choice here from Governor Walker?
Well, he's got a pretty impressive background, according to many of the veterans that I talk to in the state. They're very hopeful that he might be able to make a difference. He's a retired lieutenant colonel and a military intelligence officer. He's got 25 years of service in the U.S. Army. He's also a decorated combat veteran. He received the Bronze Star twice and the Meritorious Service Medal five times. And he's got a master's degree in Homeland Security from American Military University in Charleston, West Virginia. And he also got his bachelor's at UW-La Crosse. So he retired from the Army in 2008. He's worked for the U.S. National Guard Bureau since then as a training consultant and also an exercise officer and a threat planner at Wisconsin Emergency Management. And on top of that, he's the vice president of the Ripon Area School District Board of Education. So a pretty well-rounded background and a lot of military experience. And again, the veterans are hopeful that I've talked to that he'll be able to turn things around, specifically at those veterans' homes and especially the one at King.
What do we know about Zimmerman's experience in government?
I don't think he has a great deal of experience in government, per se, but he's got a lot of background in the U.S. military.
And what will be at the top of the to-do list as he heads into a climate that has had some trouble, some allegations of misconduct and neglect? What does he need to do first?
Well, the governor says that he is going to immediately have him do an assessment of the conditions at the veterans nursing homes around the state and the one at King. The governor also says that he's very hopeful that he will be able to represent all of the veterans in this state and also address their concerns across the board. He's going to be talking to different veterans groups. He's going to be being a liaison to those who have been having problems in the state. But at the very top of the agenda is these nursing homes, and we've also learned that he's at the facility in King today talking to staff members and talking to people who are there in order to try to do something about it.
Right. You mentioned the King Veterans Home, which has been under scrutiny in the last year. Can you remind us about what some of the stories and allegations have been coming out of that home?
Well, it's a little bit complicated, but last year, Governor Walker and the previous secretary, John Skokas, pointed publicly to the nursing home's high quality of care ratings. They were defending it against newspaper articles, which have been focusing on complaints about poor care there. But then it came to light in December that the federal ratings should have been downgraded, but there was a reporting omission by the state that caused an eight-month delay. The ratings were lowered last year because of quality of care problems that were discovered, and that was tied into the death in February of a 94-year-old resident there. There were additional citations, and the Veterans Affairs Department was fined in June $76,900 in connection with the most serious violation. And then in September, a legislative committee ordered an audit of the veterans' homes. And then it was in November that the governor announced that Skokas would resign.
And have we gotten any particulars on just what Daniel Zimmerman will be looking for at King and how he might be moving forward, given some of those issues that you just outlined?
He's going to be looking at everything. He's going to be, as I understand it, in researching this today, he's going to be pretty much looking at all of the conditions in all of the homes. He'll be talking to staff members. He'll be talking to people who are staying there, who are being cared for there, and try to get a handle on exactly what's going on in these homes.
And can you tell us a little bit about the conditions that Zimmerman is moving into, especially since his predecessor resigned not too long ago? What sorts of things happened there with his predecessor?
Well, I can tell you that this whole thing has gotten political, as most things do in Wisconsin. Rick Badger, who's the executive director of Ask Me 32, that's the union that represents the certified nursing assistants there, the food service workers, the custodians, and the others at King, he says, and I'm going to read from this statement that he put out yesterday. He says, overburdened staff have been struggling to provide the best possible care for King residents despite years of short staffing, which he blames on Act 10, which is the governor's act which reduced the powers of public employee unions in the state. He says Act 10 caused a wave of dedicated and experienced caregivers to retire. It devalued frontline jobs to the point where it's been hard to fill vacancies. And then he adds, a new face alone isn't going to undo the damage done by the governor's politically driven agenda. Badger also says his policies and neglect have made life so much more difficult for the good people on the front lines, trying hard to provide the best possible care. Needless to say, there's been pushback. Tom Evenson, the governor's deputy communications director, sent me a statement today saying this has nothing to do with Act 10. There's a nationwide shortage of nurses and nurses' aides. Governor Walker's moved to address it at our veterans' homes by increasing pay and benefits for staff, approving new positions, and altering scheduling practices. And Evenson also points out to the fact that the governor has provided nearly $100 million for the veterans' home at King, including new staff positions, increased pay, and that will include a new state-of-the-art facility that's being built there. So, yeah, we've got a lot going on.
Glenn, thanks so much for joining us and bringing us up to date.
All right. Thank you.
That was Glenn Moberg, WPR reporter, host, and news bureau chief from our Wausau bureau. He talked with us there about the new head of the Department of Veterans Affairs who was appointed today by Governor Walker. Coming up, we'll hear from a Wisconsin film producer who worked on a new documentary that follows the story of a UFO festival in small town Wisconsin. Stay with us here on Central Time. But first, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Casting is the first and perhaps most important part of a production. It's not without its hurt feelings and anger. But Jane Jeffries reminds us of the importance of every role, large and small.
Auditions were over. The show was cast. And as spring rain follows winter, the emails from parents flooded my inbox. There were always parents who tried to get their kids into bigger roles. Emily had the lead role in her kindergarten Christmas show. Logan's had acting lessons. Kristen looks more like the fairy princess. And my favorite, his role doesn't have many lines. In my experience, the number of lines doesn't equal a good role, but parents were always missing the point I tried to make with the actors. There are no small roles. If it were up to me, every actor should have a small role, at least once. That's where you learn its value. And if you can develop a small role, that tells me that you know how to do the big ones. Travis is a good example. You know, the student who always talked out of turn and wouldn't be quiet in class. One year, I cast him as a mime. Dressed in black, white face, and white gloves, he had the audience from the moment he entered the stage. Travis followed the messenger, who galloped around in a cardboard horse costume while he clapped his coconuts behind. The chemistry between these two actors was perfect. At one point, the mime falls in love with the messenger, but she rejects him. The audience was audibly let down. He had connected with them, and with nothing but gestures and facial expressions, he stole the show. We all had laughed about the fact that, in this role, Travis couldn't speak. But oh, could he communicate. In another show, Hannah wasn't cast, but she still wanted to be in the show. We needed a guard. It's been 10 years since we did this show, but recently a friend of mine was talking about it. What's the one thing she remembered? That the guard was so funny. It was her slovenly posture as she sauntered on stage. She continually stuffed small, powdered donuts in her mouth. And with only three lines, she had developed a character as inept as Barney Fife and as lovable as Buster Keaton. And that came from the actor. Just ask my husband, he loves the small roles. To him, they are the best of both worlds. Few lines to memorize, but all the fun of being in a show. And for this last role, all he had to do was shave his head, paint himself green, and say, "Ogre!" throughout the show. Our friends still talk about it 3 years later. Directing plays was never something I thought I'd do in life. I found my way in through the side stage. I hope to teach my actors other lessons through theater, that art mirrors life. One actor might give a great audition for the lead role, but so did three other people. What they don't know is that they were the best one for the role they were cast in, which isn't always center stage. The question is whether you want the role with the most lines or the one that you did to the best of your ability. Life is a lot that way.
Jane Jeffries is a playwright and teacher at UW-Stout. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Coming up, a new documentary on Wisconsin UFO Festival is out. We'll find out more. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, it's Food Friday, and we'll take a look at the flavors from a much warmer part of the country, New Orleans. But first, the truth is out there, and it might be found in the small community of Dundee, Wisconsin. Every summer, UFO believers head to a local tavern near the Kettle Moraine State Forest for UFO Days, that's D-A-Z-E, a yearly gathering of UFO enthusiasts and others who might call themselves UFO curious. Wisconsin filmmaker Mike Borchardt has been chronicling the festival for several years and has assembled his footage into a documentary film called The Dundee Project, which premiered last month at a film festival in Park City, Utah. Yesterday, Central Time's Rob Ferret spoke with Andrew Swant, who was a co-producer of the film.
Andrew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, set the stage for us. Tell us a little bit about what the Dundee Project is all about.
All right. So the film is a 20-minute documentary about a UFO festival in Wisconsin called UFO Days, and it takes place annually in Dundee, Wisconsin. And Mark Borchardt went up there. He's a filmmaker from Milwaukee. Went up there, and I think he was there for about 10 years. He went up every year. And he brought his video camera for about, I think, 4 or 5 of those years and interviewed people at the festival about UFOs and, you know, why they're there and conspiracy theories and all sorts of things.
And Mark is a character in the documentary himself. Let's give a listen to him kind of setting things up at the beginning.
I first heard of UFO Days while mindlessly drifting through the sad, infinite wastelands of cable television. Drawn into that hypnotic spell that mercilessly disembowels one's better instincts, all the while being mesmerized by the inanities of its inseparate offerings, I happened upon a channel where there was enthusiastic talk of UFOs. But it wasn't that particular phenomena that piqued my interest. Rather, it was the location of the celebratory gathering that conjured my excitement. For it just so happened to be taking place in my home state of Wisconsin, specifically a place called Dundee. I consulted the charts and realized that it was practically in my own backyard.
Now, Andrew, we've had Mark on the show before. He became famous as the subject of an award-winning documentary, American Movie. What was it like working with Mark on this labor of love for him?
Mark's amazing. I've known him for about 15 years, and he's a really fun guy to work with. He's super positive and tends to catch you off guard, and he's just interesting. And, you know, sometimes he takes some wrangling, but he knows what he wants, too. You know, I didn't try to get in the way when he was working on this film at all. This was his vision, so I just kind of helped him, you know, get it started and get it finished.
And watching this, it's sort of about the event, but it seems like it's a lot about the characters, the people who are involved with this, including Mark himself. Is that what you see as the focus of this, kind of meeting the people behind this event?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that's one of the interesting things in the film is, you know, you don't even really know if Mark is a believer, you know, if he's into UFOs or what, but you can tell that he's genuinely interested in these people at the festival. And I think he's just interested in them because they seem like unique, interesting people. And I think that comes through in the film. And then, you know, it's his own unique take. I think somebody described him as Wisconsin's Werner Herzog. And I think a little bit of that comes through in the film.
Yeah, and you say we don't know if he believes, and the people at this event, there are definitely some true believers who believe in UFOs, skeptics, and people just there for, you know, this cool annual event. There's quite a range, isn't there?
Yeah, definitely. There are people there who have seen UFOs. There are conspiracy theorists. There are people who are hoping to see a UFO because usually a UFO appears every year at this festival. And then there are people there that, you know, just want to get drunk. It takes place at a bar and outside of a bar, and it's kind of a party atmosphere, especially as the night goes on.
Talking to Andrew Swan, co-producer of The Dundee Project, a documentary film about an annual UFO festival here in Wisconsin. Andrew, one of the main characters of this film is a regular at the festival named UFO Bob. I want to give a listen to Bob a little bit. Here he is.
Look out here, and you're going to see things coming out over here tonight that's trying to tell you how to wake up. Well, how can we wake up when our ecology is going to hell, you know?
The gas prices and that?
Well, the hell with the gas prices. We should get better carburetors on cars. that's true.
How do the UFOs know that you guys are here waiting for them?
Because I have a radio station up here in Fond du Lac. Every Friday, and I talk to them.
You talk to the UFOs?
Yeah.
By radio waves?
Yeah, well, they tune into the Packer football game. The thing of it is, this is real out here. This is real. Now, I don't know, are you guys going to hang around here tonight and see this?
Yes.
Or are you just going to take this here and take it back to town and say, hey, this is some crackpot who's drinking some, what am I drinking? Samuel Adams. No, this is what I'm telling you. Hang around.
Now, Andrew, if I was going to make a fictional movie and make up a UFO enthusiast in Wisconsin, I would probably come up with something a lot like UFO Bob. This guy's quite a character.
Yeah, it seemed like there are a lot of interesting characters up there. There's another guy named Sheldon who runs some sort of a radio show about UFOs, and I think UFO Bob is a frequent guest.
And talk a little more about UFO Bob. He is definitely the believer in this documentary.
Yeah, I think Mark interviewed a ton of people over a few years, but he really honed in on UFO Bob as his main interview for this film. Bob just seems to have a certain character that Mark was drawn to, and I think, you know, actually a sizable chunk of the film is UFO Bob talking about his beliefs, and he's kind of the thread that goes throughout the whole film.
And has the documentary The Dundee Project been screening so far?
It premiered last week at Slam Dance in Park City. We had two screenings that were both sold out, and we were at the second one for the Q&A, and it went great, and we got a really good reaction. And the first screening, the premiere, we actually missed it. Mark and I were trapped in an airport in Phoenix, and we were there for 16 hours, and it was just horrible, horrible mess.
What happened? Layovers, or?
It was a series of unfortunate events. We were on the plane at, you know, 1 in the morning, sitting on the runway, and they said the flight was canceled. So we all got kicked off the plane, and there were no more flights that night, no flights the next morning on any of the airlines that were available. And then, you know, there were no hotel rooms, so we had to try to sleep on the floor of the airport, and it was pretty bad.
So you missed the premiere, you and Mark, of your own movie.
Yeah.
But what was the response? You made it to the second when you said did the Q&A. A pretty good response from the crowd there?
Yeah, yeah. They all seemed really into it. They had good questions, and Mark's Q&As are usually pretty interesting. Once you get a microphone in front of him, he's full of stories.
So you guys are both Wisconsin filmmakers. When does the Dundee project open here in the state?
I'm not sure. We submitted to a lot of film festivals, and we're just starting to hear back now. So I'm not sure. Maybe the Wisconsin Film Festival, if all goes well, or it depends. We'll have to see.
Now, you and Mark are both based in Wisconsin. Do you feel a special affection and affinity for looking for topics set here in our state?
Yeah, I mean, I just finished a film this last year that was about a radio host from Milwaukee who has a show up in Chippewa Falls, and I'm just submitting that to film festivals right now. So, and Mark, I'm not sure. This is his first film he's done in quite a while. He's directed some short music videos and things like that, but I think this is his first film since COVID. It was about 17 years ago, 20 years ago.
And I've seen some speculation online now that Mark's back in the game, maybe Coven 2 coming out. Do you have any inside knowledge about that?
I haven't heard anything. I have no idea, but I wouldn't rule it out. He's got a bunch of projects he's working on. He's got a couple of screenplays that are just about finished, and he has a bunch of things going on right now.
All right, Andrew, thanks a lot for joining us. Look forward to the film opening here in Wisconsin.
Thanks for having me.
That was Andrew Swant, co-producer of The Dundee Project, a documentary film that chronicles an annual UFO festival in Dundee, Wisconsin. Coming up after the news, it's Food Friday. We'll talk with a guest about Cajun and Creole-style cooking ahead of Mardi Gras. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we take a look at the biggest stories from around the state in this week's Wisconsin News Roundup. First, it's Food Friday. And right now, New Orleans is gearing up for its most iconic celebration of the year, Mardi Gras. And even though Wisconsin is a good distance from Louisiana, our guest today will tell us how to bring Creole and Cajun flavors into your own home. Chef Dave Heide is with us. He's the executive chef of Liliana's in Fitchburg and Charlie's on Main in Oregon. Dave is a graduate of Le Cordon Bleu Cooking School, and he's worked at a Michelin-starred restaurant in California, as well as several restaurants in the Madison area. Dave, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Nice to see you jamming away to the music already. You're ready to
great.
Go.
It was pretty good.
Well, can you give us a quick tour, through the history of Cajun and Creole influence in New Orleans cuisine?
Sure. You know, people ask me all the time, like, why'd you pick Cajun as a restaurant? You know, you're not from the South. You're not, you know, why that? And for me, one of the biggest reasons is just one of the greatest things about New Orleans cuisine is that it's a huge melting pot of culture. You know, it has... If you actually, one really fun thing to do is if you Google image Mississippi River inlets and you look at how far the Mississippi spreads into the U.S., it covers for like 70% of the United States. You can get them all merging into the Mississippi. And so the Mississippi was a huge trading port because a lot of people would bring their trades up there, and it was really the only way to get inland in the U.S. So not only was it a huge trading port, but there was also a lot of people vying for control, from the Spanish to the French to Portuguese to the U.S. Pretty much everyone wanted control of that port because the New Orleans is the only exit for the Mississippi. So But because of that, because there were so many different changes of control and all that, there were so many different influences. So as a chef, it's pretty great. You can, you know, cook French food and be cooking New Orleans. You can cook Spanish and be cooking New Orleans. You can cook, pick a cuisine and had influence. You know, there's African. It was the one of the main ports for the slave trade, again, because of that access. So huge African culture, huge Native American roots. So it has a big spread there. So for me as a chef, that was one of my favorite things. So,
well, we think of, you know, I guess New Orleans, and then we think Cajun and Creole cooking. But what is the difference between those two?
Sure. Yeah, I think, you know, up here those two words get kind of interchanged. You know, Cajun Creole, they'll call it a Cajun pasta, and it's like fettuccine Alfredo with blackened seasoning, and they call it Cajun. You know, and Cajun Creole actually have a totally different history. So the word Cajun actually comes from the word Acadian, and the Acadians were the people who were escaping religious persecution in Canada, and they came down by way of the Mississippi and ended up in the New Orleans area, and they actually stayed on the outskirts of the New Orleans area. So if you look at Cajun food, although a lot of times that's associated with spicy, Cajun food is actually more just backwater cooking. So it's crawfish and raccoon and squirrel. And we have this encyclopedia of Cajun cuisine that the cooks and I like to not make fun of, but like laugh that where are you going to get it from a local resource here.
So you don't serve raccoon and squirrel at Liliana's.
No, I don't think it would go so well. I don't know.
I don't know. Maybe not.
But yeah, like turtle, you know, all those kind of, I guess, more rodent-y type things. We're definitely in the Cajun cuisine. And then Creole has its roots in kind of African culture. So, you know, spicy peppers and rice and stuff like that. So, yeah.
And so do you serve both those sort of genres at your restaurants?
Yeah. And I think, you know, over time, those cuisines have kind of merged together, you know. So although at one point they definitely had their own thing, now both those cuisines are kind of intertwined a little bit in New Orleans. So you'll get, you know, just as, you know, the French have merged with the Spanish, have merged with everything down there, same has happened with, you know, that kind of like Bayou and Cajun and Creole.
So what are sort of the key flavors and spices that you're going to find in this kind of cooking? I know my husband, who is the keeper of one very precious red beans and rice recipe for us, he always talks about the Cajun Trinity. I mean, I can't remember what's in it except for celery, but tell us about that.
So Trinity is actually comes from kind of bastardization of the word, not of the word, but of mirepoix. And so mirepoix is the French base for almost everything. It's got 50% onion, 25% carrot, 25% celery. But carrots don't grow so well in New Orleans. So instead of carrots, you have peppers. So like at Liliana's, we actually have like, we call it our quinity, and that's in everything. So that's got red pepper, green pepper, onion, celery, and garlic. And that's in pretty much every dish, period, of the, like, you know, Cajun Creole dishes we have. So, you know, that's kind of where the roots came from, because, you know, like the carrots didn't grow.
And those flavors together, if you want to merge the peppers into one or not, they do sort of form a kind of magic flavor base, don't they?
Yeah, they're delicious. It's why it's in everything we make.
What do they do together?
Well, you know, I want to touch on one other thing you said earlier about like spicy. You know, one of the biggest thoughts people always have about Cajun Creole cooking is that it's spicy. Like, I get people to tell me that all the time. I tell my own Liliana's, it's a New Orleans style restaurant, and like 50% of the people, the first thing out of their mouth is like, I don't like spicy food. And one of the things that we've done up here in the north is that we've taken foods that were traditionally mild, and we just put a bunch of hot sauce in it and blackened seasoning in it, and then we call it Cajun. And so that's what people think it's supposed to be. So like etouffee, you know, traditionally etouffee means to smother. It's a gravy. So it's just meant to be seafood gravy. So like it's meant to have the same amount of spice as like, you know, a peppery gravy that you'd have on your turkey, you know. So, you know, a lot of these dishes have kind of, we think of them as spicy because we've made them spicy because we didn't really understand. Or like, you know, Paul Prudhomme made blackening really popular back in the 80s. But the way he did blackening isn't at all how blackening should be. You know, blackening shouldn't be cover it with an inch of blackened seasoning and then burn the crap out of it. And then, you know, but what it should be is it should be, you know, a light dusting on top, and you sear it just enough that the red turns brown, not black. And then that's a perfect blacken. So
So you're saying it does not have to be spicy?
No. In fact, it shouldn't be spicy. If it's so spicy that you can't eat it, you did something horribly wrong.
Because I'm one of those people, I actually like it, but I can't eat it anymore. So
well, then you should
come to Liliana's. Think Cajun, and then I think spicy, but this is good to know. It does not have to burn your top of your head off.
No, in fact, the best way I can describe the amount of spice that you should have is that it should be just hot enough that it puts a tiny drop of sweat on your brow. And like, you shouldn't feel it in your lips. You shouldn't feel it in the back of your throat. You shouldn't feel it on your tongue. But you should have like just one little solitary drip coming down the side.
A little glisten coming down the side. We're talking with Chef Dave Heide right now, executive chef of Liliana's in Fitchburg and also Charlie's on Main in Oregon. And we're talking about Cajun and Creole, New Orleans in general, inspired cooking now that we're into sort of the long part of winter. Mardi Gras is still ahead of us. And Chef Dave, let's talk about, you sent us a few recipes. Let's talk about barbecued shrimp.
Sure.
What goes into that one?
Well, barbecue shrimp. You know, if I were to tell people up here barbecue shrimp, I think the first thing people would think of would be barbecue sauce and shrimp. I think barbecue up here just means barbecue sauce. I don't think, you know. But barbecue shrimp is a really traditional dish in New Orleans, and it's super simple, and I love it. It's one of my favorite dishes, and it's actually going to be coming on to our menu again at Liliana's. Our menu changes a lot, but it's going to be coming back onto our menu at Liliana's soon. Barbecue shrimp is pretty simple. It's just butter and garlic, Cajun seasoning, big, beautiful head-on prawns, and a little splash of lemon juice, and you cook it just until you start to smell the spices and the Cajun seasoning, and you pull it off. And the best part about it is it is definitely not a clean dish. It's definitely going to get you dirty. The best part is you get to smell it for like hours after you've eaten. So it covers your fingers.
Okay. So that doesn't sound too, you don't make it sound very complicated either.
No, it's not complicated. You know, a lot of Cajun food, a lot of the most popular Cajun dishes anyway, you know, they're not, you know, frou-frou, you know, dishes where it's like, you know, 35 minutes of assembling a plate. It's about stuff that was cooked for a very long time that's, you know, cooked with a lot of soul and passion. So a lot of it is really simple, put together with what they had in hand.
So let's say you've got your tasty barbecue shrimp. What do you serve it over?
Honestly, just by itself.
Just by itself.
Just by itself with the butter and stuff. And then as you're peeling the shrimp, you get all the like butter and seasoning and spices all over your hands. And so it's, you know, anytime you're cooking barbecue shrimp, you'll hear this a lot. everywhere in the dining room. So,
well, I got to ask you a question before we get to our callers. And I love etouffee. Mm-hmm. And I haven't had it in a while, but I found a recipe that looked really good, looked nice and authentic, but it called for leaving the heads on the shrimp. And I could not bring myself to do that. What's the benefit of leaving the heads on the shrimp?
Tons of flavor. You know, so there's a ton of flavor. I mean, just like, you know, the bones in a ribeye, like a bone in ribeye tastes so much better than, you know, a boneless ribeye. And it's just, you know, it's added flavor. It's good.
And you can still enjoy this. You're not thinking about the tiny shrimp faces peering up at you.
No. In fact, on a slight deviation, one of the hardest things in the world to cook as a chef for me was soft shell crabs, which are really popular in New Orleans, but that's because of how you have to clean them. So not to be graphic or anything on the radio, but it's really sad. The way you have to clean them is they have to come in alive because that's how you know that they're fresh and
like
they come
lobster,
during the molting season, right? But the way you have to clean them is you have to take scissors and you have to cut their faces off, and then you have to clean out what's behind the back part. And it's like the saddest thing in the world because they're really tiny and they're so cute. So we don't serve soft shell crab at Liliana's.
I can't
bring myself to do it. It's too sad.
Well, okay, so I'm not alone with my shrimp faces and crab. But no. I do know that soft shell crab is pretty tasty.
It's so good, and I get it all the time when I'm in New Orleans. So maybe I'm just a hypocrite and I just don't want to do the action.
We're talking with Chef Dave Heide right now. He's the executive chef of Liliana's in Fitchburg and Charlie's on Main in Oregon. And we're looking right now at New Orleans inspired cooking. And we'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. What questions do you have about New Orleans cooking, Cajun or Creole inspired cooking? And are there any recipes that you've tried at home that you want to share? Maybe that you can't quite get just right. And what about jambalaya? That is one of Chef Dave's favorite. We're going to get into that when we come back. Questions about how to do that and do it well. Our number is 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. And right now we're picking up our conversation with Chef Dave Heide. He's the executive chef of Liliana's, a New Orleans-inspired restaurant in Fitchburg. And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And hey, you can check out some of Chef Dave's recipes while you're there, including one for cornbread, one for jambalaya, which he's saying is really, really good, and also that barbecue shrimp. And tell us if you have any Cajun or Creole favorite foods, a special recipe that you love, maybe an experience you had dining in New Orleans that stayed with you. You maybe want to create it back at home. Our number is 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Jeff joining us in Montfort. Jeff, hi.
Hey, hi. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, my question, you guys just got done talking about barbecuing the shrimp, or in your case, you were barbecuing a prawn. And I guess my question was it a raw prawn, or was it one that was pre-cooked and frozen?
Yeah.
Or
great question. So if you were down in New Orleans or down in Texas or anywhere along a coast, then you'd absolutely want to use fresh. One of the problems with Wisconsin, though, is that we don't have shrimp that live around here, and so most of the shrimp is brought up by truck. Shrimp is really only good for about maybe 4 days after it's caught. It deteriorates pretty quick. So although we have access to fresh shrimp, I never use fresh shrimp. We always use frozen, because it's the frozen shrimp that we have is processed as fresh as it can and instantly IQF, individually quick frozen. Same thing with our prawns, same thing with everything. It all comes in frozen. If you can get, you know, air-dropped fresh prawns, that's great. But you know, the ability to get that is pretty tough. So for us, we use frozen, but not pre-cooked. You always want to cook it in the butter, in the garlic, in all the seasoning, because that's where all the flavor kind of gets into the shell and into the protein itself. If you use pre-cooked, it'll end up just getting overcooked and chewy and rubbery, which nobody wants.
Jeff, great question. Thanks a lot. And we're going to go next to Ned in Gurnee, Illinois. Ned, hi.
Hi. I've been listening with interest to your show. I used to live in New Orleans and developed a real taste for the cooking down there, especially the Cajun, the Acadiana. I think the British expelled them and sent them to Louisiana, and they coped just fine back in the Bayou country with whatever was at hand, the okra and the shrimp and so forth. But actually, my question for the chef was, do you have a favorite recipe for king cake? And I'll hang up and listen on the radio.
King cake. My mind went to king crab, but no, we're talking about king cakes with the baby inside. Yeah,
yeah.
Tell us about that.
So king cakes, it's actually great. We're talking about, you know, Mardi Gras and everything. King cakes are the kind of ultimate sweet to give out for Mardi Gras leading up to Fat Tuesday. And for those of you guys who don't know, Mardi Gras is just like Carnival. It's the huge celebration that goes all the way up until Fat Tuesday, which is the Tuesday before Lent. So it's kind of the, let's do all the fun partying we can, because we're not going to be able to do it after Ash Wednesday. So for king cakes, we've played around a lot with a bunch of different recipes. We've tried through Googling, we tried a bunch, but our favorite one, for our beignets, traditionally beignets are made with just a regular leavened bread dough. And at Liliana's, we actually make them with brioche. So we actually have switched our king cake from a traditional king cake, dough to our brioche dough, and they turn out absolutely incredible. So, what we do is we roll the brioche out. And then put a little egg wash on it, kind of smear it with a cream cheese and cinnamon frosting, roll it up, and we do three of those, and then we braid them together and then form them into a big circle. So, brioche, as long as you let it, the only problem with brioche is that it takes a little bit longer for it to rise at room temp than a traditional dough, so you just have to make sure you've got a place that you can leave it without, you know, the cats jumping up and getting it at your house. So.
Where do you get the babies for inside of it? Is there a king cake baby supplier out there?
There sure is. MardiGrasOutlet.com. That's
okay,
where you get our beads and stuff like that. Free advertising for them, but yeah.
All right, there you go. I hope that helps. And we'll move next to Lane in Wind Lake as we talk Cajun and Creole cooking right now with Chef Dave Heide of Liliana's. You can join us at 800-642-1234. Lane, hi.
Hi. Thank you, Chef, for taking the time. I was wondering if you had a favorite Cajun roux recipe for seafood.
Yeah, sure. So roux is for those of you guys who don't know, roux traditionally in French cooking is equal parts by weight of butter and flour. In the South, they don't use butter; they use oil. And the recipe is just that. You basically want to cook it over medium low heat and just keep stirring it and stirring it and stirring it. And it has some different stages. You've got a white roux, which is basically just combine the oil and flour together. Then after you cook it for about 2 minutes, it becomes a blonde roux. And if you keep on cooking it, you get to the roux that you'd use for étouffée, which is called a brick roux. It gets kind of this like reddish color, like a red brick color. And it kind of smells like popcorn. That's how you know you're there. If you keep going, you get a dark roux. And that's what you'd use for like a lot of gumbos. And then you've got, so all of them have the same base recipe. They don't have anything else added to them except for flour and fat. But the flavors that come from them just come from how long you cook them. So hopefully that answered your question.
Great. Thanks, Lane. Good question there about roux. And before we get back to our callers, real quick, can you walk us through your jambalaya recipe, which is up right now on the Central Time Facebook page?
Yeah, sure. You know, jambalaya down south and gumbo and etouffee, although you'd think there's like a recipe for them, it's like up here saying like, oh, what's in a casserole? You know, yeah. I mean, they're kind of just a mix of whatever is around. Some of them have bases. So our jambalaya that we serve at Liliana's and the recipe that we have on your website is what's called a wet style jambalaya, which means the rice is cooked separately and then you pour the sauce over the top. That's what we serve at Liliana's. And that's mostly because if you're trying to have it stay fresh, it's easy to keep a sauce hot and it's easy to keep rice cooked separately. But once you put them together, the rice keeps expanding and eventually it just gets mushy and overcooked. So by doing a wet jambalaya, you can keep product fresher the entire time. Traditionally, what they do for jambalaya and gumbo, what they do is that it was out on these big rafts that were up and down the Mississippi River. They have these big crocks in the middle that they'd start a fire. They'd put all the stuff in about an hour before they wanted to eat. They'd dump in a bag of rice and cover it, turn the heat off, and then by the time they were ready for lunch, they'd be ready to go. So that's where a majority of these dishes came from. So our jambalaya is peppers, so it's got that quinine we talked about before, and tomatoes, and Dewey sausage, Newski's bacon, tasso ham. Tasso ham is a spiced cured ham, and shrimp.
And it's all there on the Central Time Facebook page. A taste of Liliana's there that you can make at home. And let's take another call. We've got Diane with us next in Madison. Diane, hi. Diane, are you with us?
Who did you ask for? Diane?
Diane, yeah.
Yes. Well, I lived in New Orleans for a while, and I learned to cook a lot of things that I still cook. One of my favorite things was stuffed merlotons, and, of course, I never made it, but what's famous is that Zoberge, however they pronounce that, cake. But I also love to make red beans and rice now and then, and I wonder what is the real secret to red beans and rice?
Good question, Diane. Yeah, because I have also tried several different versions before finding one I love. What do you think makes it really flavorful, Dave?
So a couple of things with red beans and rice. One of them is one of the things we do is take half of the red beans that you cook. And you have to, so the one of the things about red beans and rice, it can either taste like a big pile of mush or the beans are tough. So what we do is we cook the beans like 95% of the way and then reserve half. And then we take the other half, cook them 100% of the way, puree them, and then add them back into the beans. Mm-hmm. And it gives us really great texture. Also, one of the biggest things people forget to add is fat. And fat is flavor. So, you know, whether it's butter or oil or, you know, some people use lard. But that having that fat is what kind of gives the great texture to red beans. So even though you don't think you need it, it adds all the flavor.
What would you add? Like if you have a big crock, maybe a stick of butter or something?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it depends on the crock. You know, a big crock for a chef is very different from a big crock for someone at home.
Yeah.
But you know, putting in, yeah, like a stick of butter in with a mirepoix or the quinine that you're cooking and can add a ton of flavor when you're mixing it.
And before we wrap up, your cornbread recipe. What do you think about a really good cornbread recipe?
So Really quick, our cornbread that we have is a very traditional northern style cornbread, not a true southern recipe. True southern recipe is dry and not sweet. There's no sugar in a true southern recipe, but we're up here in the north, and so we made our recipe that we love, and it's pretty, I think it's pretty great. You guys should come try it.
Excellent. Sounds delicious. Dave, thank you so much for stopping by again.
Of course. So happy to be here.
That was Chef Dave Heide. He's the executive chef of Liliana's in Fitchburg and Charlie's on Main in Oregon. Also a graduate of Le Cordon Bleu, who's worked at a Michelin-starred restaurant, joined us today to talk about Cajun and Creole cooking. And don't forget, you can find three of his recipes, including one for cornbread, one for barbecued shrimp, and one for jambalaya, over on the Central Time Facebook page. If you're looking for the first sign of spring, well, I think we just found it. Beyonce just announced she's pregnant with twins. Her Instagram picture shows the pop singer cradling her belly, surrounded by tons and tons of flowers, looking at the camera through a pale green veil. And the picture is now the most liked image in Instagram history, naturally. And there are tons more pictures on her website. If you hover over one of them, you'll see the words, "I have three hearts." So there you have it. Fertility, flowers, birth and rebirth, and the spirit of creativity. It's all there. And I'm guessing the baby's going to be born maybe sometime like this summer. Just guessing there, judging by Beyonce's tummy. And that seems like a better way to go than believing in this whole groundhog thing from yesterday. So congrats to Beyonce and Jay-Z from all of us here on Central Time. More coming up here on the Ideas Network. Stay tuned.